From WXXI News, this is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Our connection this hour was made in 1970 in the pages of the American Journal of Psychiatry. Those pages outlined the influence of, quote, white racism on the image of the black patient, neglected problem areas, treatment accessibility, community mental health, research, and the professional functioning of psychiatrists, end quote. They also included recommendations for how practices could change to eradicate racism in psychiatry. That's more than 50 years ago. The collection of articles came 1 year after a group of black psychiatrists stormed an American Psychiatric Association board meeting and demanded racial equity. So what has changed in the last 50 years? According to Dr. Ruth Shim, not much. Dr. Shim is a physician and the director of cultural psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. She is also a former member of the American Psychiatric Association. Last year, Dr. Shim wrote an op-ed for Stat News titled, quote, "Structural Racism is Why I'm Leaving Organized Psychiatry." In it, she argued how racism, microaggressions, and how organized psychiatry has, in her words, repeatedly refused to examine its contributions to a racist system and led to her ending her membership with the organization. Dr. Shim writes that her decision mirrors that of black leaders in academic medicine who have decided to leave their faculty positions. They say the structural racism within the system is contributing to disparities in health outcomes, in representation among medical experts, and more. What would it take to change that? It's a question that will be asked at an upcoming conference in Rochester called From Theory to Practice, Moving Individuals, Organizations, and the Community. Hosted by Coordinated Care Services, it will examine concrete steps that can be taken to dismantle systemic racism. And Dr. Shim is the keynote speaker. We discuss this subject fairly frequently on this program, and we've heard from listeners who say, yes, there's a lot of theory. There's a lot of ideas about, quote, doing the work, about the reading. But what about the tangible actions to take? We hope to outline some of that this hour with our guests. We welcome Dr. Ruth Shim, Associate Dean of Diverse and Inclusive Education, Director of Cultural Psychiatry, and the Luke and Grace Kim Professor in Cultural Psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. Dr. Shim, welcome.
Hi. Hello.
And Lenora Reed-Rose is Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives and Racial Equity at Coordinated Care Services. Lenora, welcome. Thanks for being with us.
Thank you.
Lenora, remind our listeners about the mission of Coordinated Care Services.
Coordinated Care Services seeks to work with organizations across New York State and elsewhere to infuse in them policies, practices, and procedures through different aspects of our work, through data analysis, through financing, through racial equity work, and through working with programs to change the outcome of communities in which we operate.
The event is coming up on April 21st and 22nd. That's this weekend, From Theory to Practice. And you can register if you're interested. CCSI, let me do that again, CCSI.org/thehowisnow. CCSI.org/thehowisnow. If you're interested in attending. Dr. Shim, you know, the issues that you wrote about in Stat News have been decades in the making. What led you to write that piece now and ultimately make the decision to leave the APA?
Yeah, it for me, actually, it wasn't that difficult of a decision. I have spent my whole career trying to address what some people call disparities, but what I tend to define as inequities in mental health. So the unequal outcomes that we see for certain populations, particularly populations of color, as it relates to a number of mental health problems. And what I started to notice consistently over time and my time at the APA was that my commitment to these issues were not necessarily shared by all of the psychiatrists in the organization or by the leadership of the organization at all times. So for me, making a decision like that was really about getting frustrated with years and years of efforts, as you described, over 50 years and even longer of efforts to address these issues and really not getting anywhere, not seeing any change in any of the outcomes that we know exist for these inequities. And really just wanting to see tangible change being made. And obviously we know that if you if you do the same thing over and over and you get the same result, clearly we have to think about doing things differently. So it was really about taking more drastic steps and more drastic action to address these issues.
And in a moment, we'll talk about specifically what you experienced, what you saw, what prompted and really sort of over time pushed you to make this decision. Before we do that, I want to talk about changing systems, though. And, you know, this weekend I was reading the words of Tunde Wey, who is a Nigerian immigrant who is a phenomenal chef, but also a social change maker. And he is someone who does not believe or professes that he feels it's more difficult to change a system from within it. And he's even had debates with friends in the restaurant industry. Like, can you make change here and stay within the current system, or do you need to get outside of it and burn it down and start fresh and start over? You know, I've talked to friends in media who have had moments where they feel like, boy, the management at this particular organization or the ownership is unethical and I've got to get out of here. But then they say, but wait, maybe I should push back within the system. Maybe I can make the change and make it better for everybody as opposed to just, you know, walking away from it. And that's kind of an eternal debate that people have about the best way to make a change. It seems to me, Dr. Shim, you've ultimately decided that staying within it was not the way to make the change, or was not really tenable for you personally anyway. Can you kind of take me through your thought process on change from within versus change from apart?
Yeah, and it's great that you describe that, because that was my internal debate. That was the same struggle that I had. And I started my career very strongly believing that the way to change systems and the way to see real reform was from within. I even, you know, studied and looked at a lot of books about how exactly to do that work. And I spent years kind of burrowing into multiple organizations, trying to get to the central place of leadership and trying to really understand how to get to positions of power within organizations so that you can then make those changes. And what happened for me, particularly with the American Psychiatric Association, is that I received a fair amount of leadership roles. I climbed to a level of power within the organization where I really thought that I would be able to effectively make that change. And what I realized is that structural racism is so pervasive that, and that's even the definition of structural racism. It's the idea that internal forces, individual forces, are not powerful enough to overcome a system that has been designed and created over centuries to elevate white populations over populations of color. And so what happened is, as I burrowed deep within the system, I started to understand that the structure of the organization was the problem, not the individual people within the organization. And so I actually think that the response is truly the most effective way to bring about change is a combination of both. I think that some people need to be operating mm-hmm. from the inside in order to change an organization, but at the same time, there need to be people that are also kind of demanding change from the outside as well. And one more thing that really kind of helped me think about this was that I was also involved in other organizations that were much further along in thinking about how to address structural racism in their own organizations. And that helped me to understand that you can make progress in organizations when organizations are significantly committed to doing this work.
Sure. And it seems to me that, you know, if someone is going to make the calculation to stay within a structure, an organization, a company, whatever the case may be, and try to make change from within, this is just sort of a guess or an estimate on my part, but it seems that it would be important that they would feel that, number one, that they could still rise through the ranks based on the contributions they bring and still have a chance to find leadership and to be heard. That number two, that if they raise concerns, that they will not be marginalized or pushed out or frankly fired or dismissed, mocked, etc. That there is a kind of culture within the organization that says we will be able to sort of address hard questions. And, you know, we're not perfect at WXXI. Sometimes it takes a force of nature in your organization. There's a a woman in this building named Mona Isler, who's just an amazing, amazing person, who's not only great at her job, but great at getting all of us to see maybe more broader pictures and how we can be better and how we sometimes live up to our values and sometimes don't, and how we can move in that direction, and who's on your board and who's serving on your advisory committees. But the question then becomes, you know, are some organizations or structures just not permissive of that kind of self-reflection, either publicly or even privately? Are those, you know, so were those sort of pertinent questions to you?
Exactly. I think those were exactly the questions. I mean, you know, there's what we saw in the wake of George Floyd and calls for addressing racial injustice were a number of organizations coming forward and releasing statements saying, we're committed to addressing racial justice. We're committed to ending structural racism. But what you saw was that the internal workings of that organization did not necessarily reflect that. And so I point out that with the American Psychiatric Association, there's actually a fair number of Black people on the board of that organization. But when you look at kind of the highest levels of power, which are the executive leadership, the small group of people that make all of the decisions, there's actually not any representation at those highest levels of power. And so that has to be thought about and considered, and organizations need to look at themselves and say, if we are committed to doing this work, have we demonstrated that in the way that we conduct ourselves, the way that we think about these issues? And if that answer is no, or if there's an inability to even look and do that deep self-reflection, then I think that progress is not going to be made. And I'll just point out that within the American Psychiatric Association, a lot of work was done to try to address this issue of structural racism. And polls went out to members of the organization. And one of the questions on one of the polls was asking, where are the ways that you see structural racism in the organization? And a number of people, a significant number of members of the organization, in fact, the second most common response on that survey was that there is no structural racism in psychiatry. So it kind of tells you where the organization is thinking and what members are thinking, but also what the highest levels of leadership are thinking about too. And until those thoughts change, it's very hard to move people from within.
Yeah, and so let's talk about what we mean by structural racism, because, you know, even now, 2021, that's a term that, you know, I'm not sure even avid listeners to a program like this one, if you grabbed five of them at random, would all say roughly the same thing. And so to you, when you're asked, you know, what's an example of structural racism in psychiatry or in an organization, how do you define what structural racism means?
Yeah, it's a really important question, and a lot of people, there are a lot of definitions for structural racism. I particularly like the definition from the Aspen Institute, which says that structural racism is a system in which public policies, institutional practices, cultural representations, and other norms work in various, often reinforcing ways to perpetuate racial group inequity. And it actually is a multi-part definition. So it talks about how the system has identified dimensions of our history and culture that have allowed privileges associated with whiteness and disadvantages associated with color to endure and adapt over time. And the most important part of the definition is that it does not require the actions or intentions of others. And that's back to that point I made about how you don't necessarily have to be racist as an individual in an institution to see the ill effects of structural racism. And what we know is that if we got rid of all of the interpersonal racism that we see in our society, the places where we spend most of our time thinking about and talking about these horrible incidents that we hear about in society, even if we got rid of all of those incidents, we would still have structural racism due to the persistence we would still have racial and ethnic inequities due to the persistence of structural racism. So that's kind of the definition that I tend to to work off of. And then once you have that definition down, you can see examples of this everywhere. And in mental health care, I think a perfect example has a lot to do with how many people of color access mental health services in our country. So a significantly less number of Black and Latinx adults access mental health treatment and treatment for serious mental illness than white Americans. And particularly when you think about substance use disorders, almost 89% of Latinx adults reported receiving no treatment for substance use disorders, and 88% of Black adults reported receiving no treatment for substance use disorders in 2018. That's data from the Substance Abuse and Mental Health Services Administration. So when we think about structural racism, there are a lot of explanations for why that might be. And what psychiatrists have been taught is that there are cultural and there are biological explanations for this, like Black and Latinx people have a lot of stigma that white people don't have about accessing mental health services, or that they don't tend to have the same insight about the symptoms that they have, and so they minimize their symptoms. But the truth of the matter is, the most common reason that people don't seek mental health care in this country has to do with cost. And so when you ask Black people and ask Latinx people why didn't they get mental health services, it's actually because it's too expensive and it's difficult to access that care. That is a structural racism problem. That is a problem in the way that we have designed not only the general health care system, but the mental health care system, so that the majority of people cannot access care and cannot access services. And if you think about the history of this country, you can go back to ways that the American Medical Association prevented the expansion of healthcare services to everyone in this country, how they blocked those methods to try and make sure everybody had access to healthcare. And you can also think about parity laws and the fact that we have created a dual system in this country where our mental health services do not receive the same amount of attention and are not equal to the type of healthcare services. All of this has to do with our social norms or the ideas that we have about certain people and certain populations, and then the laws that we pass that reflect those ideas. So if the fundamental premise is that people that have substance use disorders and mental health problems, or people who are people of color, are not worthy of the same advantages or benefits in a system that's structurally racist, then we pass laws in which the care that we offer for those people is not the same as what we offer for people who don't have those particular conditions or who are not people of color. And then that leads to this unfair and unjust distribution of opportunity that then leads to a number of poor mental health outcomes that we end up seeing. And that is really what's driving these inequities that we see in mental health care outcomes.
This is actually a really helpful specific definition, and I'm grateful that you bring this up, just because this does go beyond theory and it puts it right into the forms of an actual concrete example. And, you know, it to me, just hearing the story, when you brought up the numbers, you know, 89% and 88%, you know, categorically, Black and brown people are not getting, you know, essentially the care that they need, much higher percentages than white adults in this country. And to hear, you know, perhaps a psychiatric association, largely white organization say, well, that's, you know, that's because there's the cultural thing. There's stigma. They don't want to go. They don't want to get treatment, or they don't understand their own symptoms or their own problems. That is a convenient way of ignoring decades of economic dispossession and wealth disparity that was a choice that this country made.
Absolutely.
That was a choice. Absolutely. So identifying that as a piece of structural racism, to me, is pretty clear and profound. Then the question becomes, what do you want to see in its place as a solution? So you bring up laws, advocating, certainly, you know, we could talk about, you know, universal health care. If we don't end up in the place of some form of universal health care, are there solutions within a current system that are within reach that you can see?
Yeah, and that's, you know, a huge challenge is again, it's almost that same debate about do you fix a problem internally or from outside. It's also, can you fix a problem incrementally or does it have to be kind of a massive change? And I again think that the answer is both for those things. I think that ultimately it's huge shifts and a movement toward universal health care and a movement toward true parity, where mental health care is truly equalized in terms of the services and the reimbursement that people get for mental health, that providers get for providing mental health care services. But incrementally, little things that could be done that would make a huge change just involve things like expanding Medicare in states. Expanding Medicaid in states. So what we see is that many states did not expand Medicaid under the Affordable Care Act, and we are starting to see inequities grow in those states. And many of those states happen to be southern states in which there were already large differences in health outcomes, and particularly mental health outcomes, for people of color compared to white people in those particular states. And so we have enough data to very clearly say a small act like expanding Medicaid in states that did not expand could make a huge difference in trying to kind of close this gap, or at least narrow the gap of health inequities in certain areas. So there is incremental change that can be made. But ultimately, I think we have to think about both of these issues.
Yeah, and when we think about change that has to be made, if someone wants to make a change within the system, they're going to need, I don't know if the term is allies, which is probably overused, but just, you know, people who have traditionally held power, often white people, to understand issues, to really sort of do some work on making change. And was listening recently to a podcast with Chris Hayes of MSNBC with the linguist John McWhorter, and you know, they were both sort of maligning the oft-used phrase, do the work, because in their view, do the work too often, not always, but too often comes to mean mostly white organizations doing an anti-racism training or saying, everybody read Robin DiAngelo's book, and therefore you're doing the work. And real work is systemic change, understanding, really economic disparity and income disparity, and doing the hard work, and you know, housing and opportunity, and doing the hard work that would move those mountains, as opposed to just reading a book and saying, you know, I get it now. But what are you actually doing? And so they were sort of maligning the idea of doing the work as just, hey, I went to a workshop, or we hired somebody to give a training, or I read this book. And I think that there is something valuable in examining what maybe your blind spots and being open to change. I mean, my 25-year-old self and my 35-year-old self were very, very different in how we probably understood the world and what we had learned about it and et cetera. But do you find something, Dr. Shim, valuable in saying that is not the only work? And too often we say do the work and it sort of becomes this, well, we did a training, we read a book, et cetera.
Yeah, and that's why I'm glad that Lenora is joining us on this call, because I think that the training is actually critical. You know, I do think that conferences that start to raise awareness is moving us towards this place where we start to think about why these issues are important. Mm-hmm. And so what I've found is that I don't disagree that we have to do the work and we have to get away from trainings, and particularly one-off trainings where it's much more focused on helping people feel, helping people work through their guilt around these issues, because people have a lot of guilt about these things, a lot of guilt about racism, about structural racism. So, you know, you attend a training and then you feel better and then you don't have to do anything. That is not particularly helpful. But the other thing that I think is important, and why trainings are really critical, is that a huge number of people in this country, based on the way we were all raised, based on the fact that certain historical information that we should have learned in school as part of our history classes have been glossed over, and pretty much misinformation has been allowed to kind of percolate to the top of our educational system. Because of that, what you find is that in many organizations, in many places where people should be doing the work, they do not have mastery or understanding of the basic tenets of what structural racism is, how it has existed in our society. And so there's a lot of work that needs to be done around educating people on that. And I find this is a huge problem in medicine. Most physicians really don't understand how structural racism impacts medicine. And part of the reason is because it is never taught in medical schools, or it hadn't traditionally been taught. I think we're seeing improvements in that space now. But because that hasn't been taught, people tend to default to those same thoughts that we described before. They tend to think that, oh, there's something wrong with this particular population at a fundamental cultural level, or even at a biological level, where you have medical students that believe that Black people have thicker skin than white people, or that Black people have fewer nerve endings. In today's society, we have medical students that believe that false information. So the work has to be done, and we have to get down to action. But I don't think people can move on this until they truly understand what the issues are. And so that's where the trainings and the work, and even White Fragility and Robin DiAngelo, that's where that work becomes really important. Because if you are too fragile to even do that self-reflection, then there's no progress that's going to be made. So I'm a big proponent of training and education, and I think it has to be sustained. And somehow we have to teach people how to recognize that this is a lifelong process. That doesn't mean that if you don't have an understanding of these issues that you're a bad person, but it does mean that you have a responsibility to educate yourself and to get to a place where you know more about these topics than you think you do.
Can I ask Lenora Reed-Rose, the Senior Director of Strategic Initiatives and Racial Equity at Coordinated Care Services, to weigh in on this too? Go ahead, Lenora.
Yeah, I do agree with, thank you, Evan. I do agree with Dr. Shim, because it's an and not an or, that the training needs to be done. It takes the education that I'd say, even as a Black person, a Black woman, I've had to learn a lot to understand what structural racism is and what it means, to begin to even think about how do you dismantle it, and just be very conscious that as an individual, the systems, it is so baked into our systems and into our policies and our procedures and our laws, that it will take a major shift in our mindset, and also educating us so we can do the work. Because like Dr. Shim said, if you don't know it, you can't address it. And very often we tend to blow training off as, oh, it's just another training, it's just another thing that that you go to, you tick the box, and we all hug and sing Kumbaya at the end of it. But when it's done very intentionally and being very deliberate about it, then it does play a role, and a very important role. It helps to change the mindset. Then we can get into things like, what do we need to do on an organizational level? We need to look on the policy alignments. We look on programs and strategies, evaluation. We need to get to a common language and what that means.
Talking to Lenora Reed-Rose from Coordinated Care Services and Dr. Ruth Shim, Associate Dean of Diverse and Inclusive Education, Director of Cultural Psychiatry, and the Luke and Grace Kim Professor in Cultural Psychiatry at the University of California, Davis. And they're talking about an upcoming event this coming weekend, Friday, Saturday, From Theory to Practice, Moving Individuals, Organizations. I'm sorry, it's not Friday, Saturday. Why is my brain totally mistaken? Lenora, thank you. Can you jump in and save me here? When is the event?
It is Wednesday and Thursday, the 21st and the 22nd.
Thank you, and my apologies, Lenora. But listeners, two things. We will post links to it on our various platforms if you want to find a way to register and learn more. The easy way to do that is to jump online for the Wednesday-Thursday event, ccsi.org, www.thehowisnow.com/thehowisnow. After we take this only break, we'll talk a little bit more about the specific goals and intentions here, and we'll talk to Lenora about individual, organizational, and community change, how they differ, and how maybe some of the work you do in this kind of training lays the groundwork one for the other. And we've got some feedback from listeners as well for Dr. Shim on the other side of this break. Coming up in our second hour, New York State Attorney General Letitia James hired one of the country's leading police defenders to offer expert testimony in the Daniel Perud case. In dozens of cases, Dr. Gary Vilk has essentially argued the same thing. He tells juries that police did nothing wrong, even when someone dies in their custody. That's exactly what he told a grand jury in Rochester, and those grand jurors decided that Rochester officers should not be charged. So why was he hired? We examine next hour. This is Connections. I'm Evan Dawson. Let me get EJ. EJ writes to me to say, Evan, listening to the wonderful Dr. Shim on WXXI right now, I agree that structural racism had been largely ignored by the APA, but the survey she mentioned doesn't take into account that most of us don't answer it. There are more than 30,000 psychiatrists in the APA, and fewer than 20% answer the survey. EJ lists herself as a geriatric psychiatrist at the University of Rochester. What do you think, Dr. Shim?
I think that I totally agree with EJ, and I am so glad that they brought this point up, because it's something that I forgot to mention, which is just how disengaged I think that the membership can sometimes be around these issues and just in general. So yes, the response rate for this particular survey was abysmal. There was a significantly, I think that the responses were, I can't remember the number, but it's true. There's about 30,000 psychiatrists that are members of the American Psychiatric Association, and it was not close to what we would consider to be a statistically reasonable response rate in science. So that data has to be taken with a grain of salt. And then you have to think about who are the people who chose to answer that survey? Who are the psychiatrists that felt inclined to respond? I would say that probably there was, if we're going to try and do some speculation about the data, probably people that were particularly impacted by structural racism and are very aware of structural racism felt the need to respond. But then probably there was a large faction of psychiatrists who also maybe do not think that structural racism is a problem and maybe feel very strongly about that, that also felt the need to respond to that survey. So I do think that it's worth kind of thinking a little bit more intently about the data. And I really thank EJ for that comment and to remind us to always question data a little bit.
From the email, Riti writes, great show. Thank you, Dr. Shim and Ms. Reed-Rose. Thank you to Dr. Shim for highlighting the cost barrier to mental health care. I wanted to add that time is also an issue for many working class people. Many people in food service or retail jobs have multiple jobs and unstable schedules, often finding out about their schedules just a week in advance. How can the mental health care systems accommodate this? And I wanted to add that many mental health issues are themselves tied to structural issues. Poverty and racism can cause significant emotional distress, depression, anxiety. There's little a mental health professional can do when the issues are much bigger than mental health care. How can mental health care professionals assess this as well? Dr. Shim?
This is such a great comment and question. And so the caller or emailer is really saying that, is really highlighting this important part of this work, which is really about the social determinants of mental health. And so what we know, I talked about how our ideas about how we think about people and then that determines the laws that we pass, and then that leads to unfair and unjust distribution of opportunity. But then that unfair and unjust distribution of opportunity then leads to what we call these social determinants of health and mental health, which are all of these environmental factors, all these policies and practices that really lead to the risk factors for mental health problems. So these are things like adverse childhood experiences, unemployment or unstable income and poverty, homelessness and food insecurity, not being able to access healthcare, or even kind of more larger environmental scale things like climate change and neighborhood disorder and pollution, that all of these things are factors that set the context for increased risk for mental health problems. And so many mental health professionals are not trained to address those problems. A lot of mental health professionals can't help people get jobs. But helping somebody get a job is really a really effective way of improving people's mental health outcomes. And so that's also why we see in Medicaid, a lot of times there is support for things like supported employment and supported education. So you see reimbursement happening for job coaches that can work with people with mental health problems to help them get a job. So we've figured this out to some extent, and we're starting to reimburse around some of these social determinants, but not necessarily to the degree that we need to see kind of widespread change. And I also want to point out that this point about how the mental health care system is structured to not help people access services is a huge problem. It's so multifactorial. So one of the other issues is we have this massive workforce problem within mental health, and there are there's a huge shortage of psychiatrists as well as other mental health professionals like psychologists and social workers, and even peer support specialists. So the entire workforce is very lacking. But among psychiatrists, almost 50% of the psychiatrists in this country actually don't participate in any type of insurance plan. So there's a significant number of psychiatrists who just have kind of private cash-only based practices. And so clearly, somebody who is in working class or of lower income is not going to be able to pay out of pocket to see that psychiatrist. So we have already a small workforce, and then we have a larger proportion of that workforce that is completely opting out of the public mental health system. And so we have a smaller pool of people that are providing these services, and it is absolutely not enough to be able to reach the needs of the population. And that's really one of the reasons why we're just doing a very bad job of providing services to people. And of course, when we do a bad job of providing services to people, populations that are more oppressed and more marginalized feel that worse than the regular or the general population. And so that's how we see people of color and people with serious mental illness and substance use disorders, populations that are more likely to be oppressed. We see them having these worse outcomes, and we see these mental health inequities worse in these populations.
Randall emails the program to say, Evan, looking across race, what is the disparity in percentage between white poverty and black and brown poverty and the access available to mental health assistance? In other words, what role does poverty play, regardless of race, in the access to mental health assistance? Dr. Shim?
So poverty absolutely plays a huge role, and I think that it kind of relates to what I was saying in answering the last question, that so yes, white people, black people, Asian people, Latinx people, people of color, and white people, all populations have difficulty accessing health, mental health services. So it's definitely not something where we can say, oh, this is a particular problem only for people of color. It is a problem across the board. And rural populations, which are majority white, have difficulties, severe difficulties accessing accessing mental health services. So this is not a problem where the inequities fall only along racial lines. We see these inequities among any population that is oppressed or marginalized, and poor people are the most oppressed and marginalized in our society, or they're highly oppressed and marginalized in our society. So yes, this is a problem across the board, but it really also gets to this issue of intersectionality, which is that when you start to combine some of these oppressed identities, that's when you really see a worsening or a kind of a synergistic effect in which these problems get worse. So it's a problem for all poor people across races. But then if you happen to be a poor person who is Black, or a poor person who is Latinx, or a poor person who is Black and trans gender, for example, then you start to see these outcomes just get worse and worse and worse. So there is a across the board problem, and then there is a synergistic worsening for more oppressed identities and more marginalized identities.
And let me, before I turn back to Lenora Reed Rose, talking about the kinds of training and the kind of focus on that takes a look at the different individual and then organizational and then community change. I just want to ask you a little bit, Dr. Shim, about some of what you wrote about a different but certainly related issue. It goes beyond sort of the macro and the policy and the structural to the micro. And you wrote about microaggressions, and I'm going to quote from some of what you wrote and ask you to talk about it. You wrote, quote, "During my residency, I was selected to receive the APA GlaxoSmithKline Fellowship, now known as the APA American Psychiatric Association Foundation Leadership Fellowship. Its goal is to prepare future leaders in the field of psychiatry. I was delighted and proud until I read the press release bearing the headline that 10 residents had been awarded the fellowship. Only 9 names were listed in the release, and the name of the only Black person in the fellowship class, mine, was left off. I was hurt but didn't at the time feel the need to correct this oversight and remained silent. APA leaders have confused me with other Black women psychiatrists, bearing no resemblance to me, interrupted one-on-one conversation I was engaged with without acknowledging my presence to speak with the white man I was conversing with, and have accidentally forgotten to acknowledge me when publicly recognizing members for their service to the organization. In each instance, I remained silent. I did not want to make a big deal out of something that seemed so small." End quote. How common were these occurrences, and how common are they for your colleagues of color who you've talked to?
Sadly, they are the norm rather than the exception. And so, you know, for most people, I think when I talk to my colleagues, and particularly, you know, we spend a lot of time kind of venting with each other in order to manage our stress and to deal with the challenges. But this is actually, this happens so regularly that I think it starts to become just a part of your life that you come to accept. And one of my one of the great researchers on racism and health, Dr. David Williams, was on 60 Minutes last night talking about how this microaggression work kind of impacts you, and he described it as you know, the hypothesis that many researchers have talked about is this weathering effect. And he talked about how, you know, if there is a leak and there is water dripping onto the sidewalk, if it's just one or two drips onto the sidewalk, it's not a particularly big deal. But if day in and day out that dripping is going on and on and on, you are going to see the sidewalk will start to show signs and impact of weathering. It will start to corrode under that small little drip over extended periods of time, and that's what my colleagues and our patients, those are the experiences we have, these small drops day in and day out that over time just really begin to weather and wear us down. And there has not been, and so that affects our mental health, and we know that. We have study after study to show that discrimination, that those individual everyday instances leads to poor mental health over time. And yet, in the field of psychiatry, we have not spent a lot of time looking into how to treat that, how to provide appropriate therapies, appropriate interventions for that wearing down, that for racial trauma. There's not really work being done, intensive work on how to heal populations from racial trauma. And it seems to me that psychiatrists should be focused on this major contributor to poor mental health outcomes, and yet it's never been something that's been kind of the focus of the field.
On that subject, let me let Rich in Rochester weigh in on the phone. Go ahead, Rich.
Hey, how you doing, Evan?
Good, sir.
Evan, you know, the fact that we have all this knowledge is good, but as a black man, I cannot believe the levels of, and I know that racism is endemic, but I've come to the conclusion there is nothing it doesn't touch. And as far as the word microaggressions, I'm not a fan of it because it people take it as micro, as small, as insignificant. And we need to think of a better word than microaggressions. This does not give credence to the damage these things done. These aren't micro. And I think we need to figure out a better word to explain what's going on, because micro is not the term we want to use. Mm. That's not the prefix we want to use.
Okay.
And that's just one of my views. And just my level of frustration in all of this, just it's, I don't even know. I don't even know. It's just, to listen to this program is just, it's painful.
I know. I take the point, Rich, and much love to you. I always appreciate your phone calls. Thank you. Let me ask Dr. Ruth Jim what you think of his feeling about the term microaggression.
Yeah, first of all, I just want to acknowledge that that feeling, that exhaustion, the fact, the awareness that structural racism and racism impacts every aspect of our lives. I feel it. I experience it. I live it. And I know exactly that feeling, and it's overwhelming. It's truly overwhelming to really think about it and to do this work day in and day out and to think about it. I almost wonder that sometimes awareness can be really damaging. Sometimes the obliviousness protects us. But I just really want to, I just want to acknowledge, Rich and thank him for just sharing that. And I also want to say that, the microaggressions comment is well taken. It was a comment that was, developed by the psychiatrist Chester Pierce many years ago, and I think it was an important way to acknowledge this undiscussed kind of idea that these are small daily interactions that people don't acknowledge. But I do think that we are progressing to a point now where it isn't so micro. We do now understand that these small daily interactions are massively problematic. I think the worst part about a microaggression is it's so unclear as to whether or not it's an issue of your race or if it's just, you know, something else that's going on, that people spend an extreme amount of time kind of mentally replaying, rehashing, thinking about it. It becomes consuming. And that is very mentally exhausting, to kind of consistently rehash these events and these moments and replay them and think about that. So I'm of the belief that they are absolutely not micro. You know, I think terminology is very important. Ibram Kendi doesn't necessarily use the term micro, and he has he's in favor of using the term racial abuse for describing microaggressions. And I think racial abuse is a perfectly acceptable term to kind of describe these impacts. I mean, I think that it is important to distinguish these everyday impacts from, you know, the horrible, massive, clear, you know, macro aggressions and clear racial, clear instances of interpersonal racism that are much, much more broader and aren't these everyday acts, but are major acts, including, you know, people losing their lives in many ways. So it is important to distinguish, but it doesn't diminish the impact of these events.
Thank you, Rich. Last couple minutes, I want to ask Lenora Reed Rose about the upcoming event. It is titled From Theory to Practice, Moving Individuals, Organizations, and the Community. It is Wednesday and Thursday online. You can register at the website for Coordinated Care Services, ccsi.org/thehowisnow. And registered participants can choose to attend one of three concurrent events with virtual workshops focusing on individual, organizational, and community change. Lenora, in our last couple of minutes, how do you see those being different? You know, so people may be more interested in sort of individual change, organizational, community. Can you talk a little bit about those differences?
Yeah, thank you, Evan. If we think about communities, if we think about organizations, they're all made up of individuals. And it is us as individuals that will make a huge difference to how we operationalize the definition that Dr. Shin spoke about when it comes to structural racism. So we will focus on, as an individual, what does that mean for you? And to you, we'll also look on what does it mean as a Black person and as a white person. So those would be two separate workshops. Then we'll get into, from an organizational perspective, looking on it from a as racism as a technical challenge. We look on it as a white supremacy. We look on how those play out to it being an adaptive leadership challenge. Then we think of one of the workshops that I'm very excited about is looking on our own organization, CCSI. So we have gone through some of the work that we're going to be asking folks to go through. We have recognized that we need to do our own work. Like my grandmother had a saying that you need to take the matter, which is the crux and all the garbage stuff, out of your own eyes before you go take it out of somebody else's eyes, or clean your own house first. So we have embarked on the journey to begin to clean our own house. So we're going to be sharing that conversation with our participants as well, that it's not an easy road. I mean, it seems like it's very easy to say, oh, we're going to dismantle racism, we're going to do this. It's not easy. And pretty much we're saying it takes all of us when it comes to our communities. Our communities will very often dictate if we want to acknowledge it, yes or no. Communities will dictate what organizations do. So we have Black Lives Matter, and a lot of folks have gone on, and they have put great, nice statements on their websites. They've made some changes, but they've not really gone into the how do we do this.
Well, and Lenora, let me just jump in, only because we're going to lose you, Lenora, and I want to say ccsi.org. So to Lenora Reed-Rose and Dr. Ruth Shim, they will continue the conversation Wednesday and Thursday, and you can join them then.